Brigadier Vickers, Reel 3. Could you tell me about the divisional commander and the way in which he melded the three disparate elements of his division together?
Well, the divisional commander was General Jim Castles, later CIGS and a field marshal. And he was posted to command the Commonwealth Division from being head of the UK liaison staff in Australia. And I was told this in, under top secret conditions in London, and I was simply delighted because I knew General Jim. I'd never served under him, but I'd met him playing cricket for the army and played golf with him, and I had a great admiration for him. The other thing that delighted me was that Brigadier Pike, who later became Lieutenant General Sir William Pike, had been a G1 at the Staff College when I was there, and he was appointed CRA, and I in fact flew out to Korea with him. So I knew the CRA, and I had tremendous admiration for the divisional commander. And that augured well for the future. The staff was set up, I think I've said before, that the GOC, the CRA, the G1 and the AQ, and I think the CRE, were all Commonwealth appointments. In fact, my posting order was from four governments, which was important when you had to perhaps argue with perhaps a Canadian or Australian, because you were, in fact, appointed by his government. So you had that additional authority, which was very seldom had to be used, if ever. The rest of the division, as headquarters, we picked up most of the signal regiment from the three independent brigades, but the divisional headquarters signal regiment and the rear link and so on and so forth was very hastily mobilised in England, that sort of thing. The defence platoon was organised out there. All the bits and pieces, like batmen and drivers and what have you, until they were taken over by a special New Zealand company that came up. Not New Zealand batmen, that never works. Drivers. They did all the divisional headquarters driving. And excellent they were too. The staff itself, as I remember it, the DAAG was always British, the DAQMG was always Canadian, the staff captain A, there were two, one was Australian and one was British, and so on, but the posts on divisional headquarters were allocated to Commonwealth countries, and we had, I don't remember any problem, and they were always, they were pretty hand-picked chaps. And I can't really say much else how the divisional headquarters was set up. I arrived in Tokyo, went off to the embassy, and was pitched into a cocktail party, feeling dirty, tired, disheveled, and not jet lag, prop lag in a York, which took hours, days to get to Tokyo. And then I was told at the embassy about 10 o'clock that the G1 was arriving from Canada at midnight. So I said, I'd like a car, please, and they gave me a car. And I went down to Tachikawa, USAF base outside Tokyo, and waited, and eventually a Canadian North Star, RCAF, came in. And I went and out stepped a chap, a lieutenant colonel, in a Highland Regiment of Canada, and I looked at him, and by God, I'd been on the same staff college course with him, and it was Dick Danby. He was the G1, and we celebrated our reunion, slightly unwisely, but there were never any problems between the G1 and the AQ after that. I'd known Dick, we'd had a good time together in 1941 at the staff college. We'd never met since, but we trusted each other, and he was a G1. I really very little to say about the setup. That's the way it happened. We gathered in Japan. We then went over by sea to Pusan. We had 3 weeks in Pusan, whilst two ships came in with our vehicles and the rest of the divisional staff and some from England and the signals and odd extra bits of, I might say, all the heads of services were British and their staffs were British, but they bought in Commonwealth people onto their staffs as they were there, which was the thing I helped do. There was no problem over there. And we gathered at Busan, and I went up and spent a fortnight going round the independent brigades and seeing them and seeing Corps headquarters and generally preparing the way. And then we moved up by road. That was our Fred Carno's army. We hadn't done much before. And I remember the signaller in my high-powered CB, HPCV, I think they were called, got very nervous. We were in the mountains above Taiku somewhere, night-stopping, and he was convinced he was going to be attacked, and he shot his, was it a 31 set or whatever, a great big high-powered set that filled up. He shot it one night, and that was the end of that set. He never used it. I can't say any more about divisional headquarters.
Had all the people who were serving the divisional headquarters had the same basic training in staff procedures and staff work?
Those that had been to the staff college, yes, the DAQNG, the DAAG, the G2, some of them more, I don't think below second grade level they'd been to the staff college. One of the heads of service had been, but that leads me to one of my favourite points. I have found in a fairly varied experience around the world in the little wars, both in Africa and the Far East, since 1948, that the one marvellous institution which is worth its weight in gold is the Staff College in Camberley. In Korea, the G1 and myself had both been at the Staff College, had our DQs and DAs and G2s, we spoke the same language. I found this of enormous value. Some of the Canadian COs had been to the Staff College, the Field Regimental Command, I remember, had been. One of the Australian Battalion Commanders had been to Camberley. And it was a common language, and you understood it. But I met that in Africa, in the Congo, and places like that. The chief of staff of the Turkish regiment in Korea had been at the Staff College. The commander-in-chief of the Emperor of Ethiopia's bodyguard that eventually arrived in Korea had been a student of mine, Prince Andon, at the Staff College. The French battalion commander had been at the Staff, the RAF Staff College, actually. But there was a common basic knowledge and method of procedure. And gosh, it saves so much time. And it leads to efficiency.
So there was a common philosophy amongst all the...
Oh, very much so. There was a common Commonwealth philosophy. It was all on the British system, but it was very good.
When you got hold of the independent brigades and tried to migrate them, presumably they had larger staffs than they would have required as brigades part of a division. What happened to their staff officers? Did they come into the brigade to the divisional staff?
My memory is that they hadn't got in. They had a brigade major, they had a DAQMG, they might have had an additional staff captain. Their services were certainly a little bigger because they were brigade groups. A workshop was a bit more than an infantry brigade workshop. I think we let them run down. We let them keep their fat, and they ran down. And when the chap was due for replacement, if he wasn't on the establishment brigade, he wasn't replaced. No, I don't. I think they were pretty well down to scale. But of course, I sympathise with them. But it was a bit difficult to go to 29 Brigade, the Acanthus Force, and to say to the DAQMG, he was a very good chap and had done a marvellous job in mobile warfare for 7 months. Now, this is what you've got to do. This is what I want you to do, and I hope you'll do it willingly. And there was a certain amount of reluctance. But not only did I have it with the sort of AQ to the administrative staff, but the G1 had it with the brigade majors, who liked to feel that they were the sort of the super operations staff officer, and the divisional commander undoubtedly had it with the brigade commanders. But I only once had to say on behalf of the G1, who was a Canadian, I had to go to a brigade major who was British service and say, look, my friend, your confidential report's going to be written by your brigadier. It's then going to be backed by the divisional commander. And if you play silly buggers with the G1, what can you expect? Now, be sensible. This division's going to work, and it can work, but it needs you to get into the act and to be keen and be sensible. And if you're not, you're a fool, because it can do you no good. And luckily, he saw the light, and he retired as a very honourable Major General, so all is well. But if I can talk about the divisional commander for a minute, I mean, I didn't realise it at the time, but my gosh, what a responsibility. He had a very volatile Australian commander-in-chief called Red Robbie, who lived in Tokyo. He had the Prime Minister's representative to the Allied Supreme Commander, who was a Vice Marshal called Boucher, I think, who lived very close to MacArthur in Tokyo. And then he had a base commander who was a brigadier, and I can't remember, Roland. Quiet, efficient, get on with it. He was a great help, and he was very understanding. We had a full colonel. Commanding our sort of forward base in Seoul was an extraordinary Irish guardsman, whose name I won't mention, who really was an extraordinary chap. But he went, because he was promoted, and a gunner full colonel came in and ran the sort of forward area. Very understanding, very nice chap, no problems there. But there wasn't much he could do to influence the movement of the ship carrying the ammunition, the Indian Ocean, and so on and so forth, but he was a good link. And then Jim Castles arrived, and I remember the enthusiasm with which I met him, and Willie Pike knew him, the CRA, we were there, so we were terribly pleased to see him. And he was introduced to his G1, Dick Danby, and literally within 48 hours they were getting on well. And Jim simply radiated confidence and let's get on with it, and gosh, we've got some marvellous problems to solve, haven't we? Let's solve them, and let's get on. And he said, this headquarters will move by road from Pusan to our operational area on such and such a date. 25th of May, I think, and it'll move. And he meant it, and we did. And then he said, he turned to the G1 and said, I want you, by the, whatever it was, to have done this. And he gave a list of tasks. This was the second day he'd arrived. And he turned to me and said, I want you to have done this. This was all a question of going up to the forward area, seeing the independent Robert Barons and paving the way up there. And I had to report to him every 48 hours, myself or my dear QMG, a Canadian who just arrived, of the status of the equipment of divisional headquarters towards meeting the moving date, things like that, and if you needed to stick a pin in the base sub-area to get more vehicles or get them serviced, that could be done. But we were perfectly clear what we had to do. And it was as we were getting ready to go there that I realised all these problems of the power of each commander of each national contingent to refer back to his national government, the enthusiasm but the total lack of understanding of the Americans how to handle a British combat formation, the difference in attitude between the people sitting in the base 600 miles away over the sea and those people sitting in Korea, the fragility of our LFC and our dependence upon American movements, although we had movement control people in with them, and the problems began to look pretty formidable. But I think General Castles did a marvellous job. He certainly enthused his divisional headquarters with the certainty that the Commonwealth Division was going to be the best division in Korea. And then he set about the robber barons. They were fairly powerful people, thank God they were. The Canadian was charming, but, you know, he was reluctant to give up his kingdom to another bigger king. The 29th Brigade commander took a bit of bringing to heel and was a bit, perhaps, that brigade was a bit quick off the mark and a bit sly at times. They used to, for instance, they didn't quite trust our petrol supply arrangements. And I found that they had their own private system of getting petrol for the Americans. Well, we had to pay for the petrol of the Americans, strictly cash basis. And there was a thing called the Korean Operations Pool Account. But I had the equivalent of Lieutenant Colonel and four majors from F2 sitting on my rear divisional staff, keeping the books. And I found that this 29th Brigade were doing a private thing. So I went to the G4 at Corps and explained to him and said, you know, and I said, I'd be very glad if you'd take it away. And he said, no sooner said than done. It was taken away. And an infuriated DAQMG of the brigade rang me up the next morning and said, we can't bloody well move place. There's an American petrol point gone. I said, well, what about using a British one? It's there. Well, we don't even want them. Those sort of things you had to do to be a little tough. And it wasn't until we did our first major operation, 2-brigade attack over the Imjin, which was a success, that people began to think about the Commonwealth Division. We then did this major divisional attack with the other four divisions. We did this core attack, and it was extremely successful. And then people used to say, I'm in the Commonwealth Division. And they used to look at Americans and say, and we got our divisional flashes by then, and things like that. And very quickly, thanks to Jim Castles, who was here, there, and everywhere, everybody knew him. And he really was a great commander, and he could speak how to do. He'd been a commander of the parachute brigade, so he could wear a red beret when he went to the Indian Parachute Field Ambulance and talked how to do to them. He'd been in Australia, had a lot of Australian friends. He got on very well with the Canadians. And he dominated the British by leadership. He was a good choice. My gum, he was. And he was very good at getting on with the Americans, and he was very firm. And I can remember him saying in my presence to the Corps commander that he said, well, I've considered what you've told me to do, sir, and I am very reluctant to do it. Why, said the American Corps commander, why, Jim, what's wrong? And Castle said, well, I can't see any reason for doing it, and it's going to cost a lot of casualties, and I don't think it'll achieve anything. But in any case, you haven't left enough time to do it, and I don't think I can do it. And the Americans saw that and didn't do it. So it was not a trial of strength for the Americans, but it was an indication that he was prepared to say, half a mo, Joe, let's look at this again. And he was very good. Because when he went to a corps commander's orders group, they copied the idea from us, an orders group, and they gave these absolutely unintelligible orders. The Marines used to ignore them. The cavalry used to quiver, and the National Guard, the 45th Division, used to quiver with anticipation. And the ROC, Republic of Korea Division, didn't understand them in any case. So they were really rather funny, and we used to say, well, you tell us what you want to do and we'll do it, but tell us. And eventually the Marines got to that system, but the orders issued by the Corps headquarters, the confirmatory orders, I sent some of them back to the Staff College, and they were a different system. They meant things to the American command structure. They meant nothing to us. And all we wanted to know was what we got to do, what the program was, what support we could get, and so on and so forth. We got a modus operandi eventually, but they didn't take the trouble to find out how British combat formation works.
Did the General Castles, have a a daily routine in his headquarters? Or did he take each day on an ad hoc basis?
No, that was a routine. We'd have prayers, rather varied, up at 6 in the summer, up at 7, 7:15 in the winter. They would last anything from, if it was a quiet day, 15 minutes. We'd all... Attention at prayers was compulsory for the AQ and one grade 2 staff officer. The whole of the G staff and the intelligence staff were there. CRA was always there, CRE was always there. A representative from the 37 Engineer Regiment. And there was a little corner room on side with four chairs where visitors were entitled, were encouraged from the division to pop in and see, but they didn't say anything. And there were always chairs for the brigade commanders if they came. This was a ritual. This was laid on by the G1. It was a set format. We knew exactly what it was. I knew when I had to stand up and say my piece, or the DQ, which was frequently nothing to report, and sat down, or anything of interest. He would then stay behind and say, I want to talk to so-and-so, 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 which was generally the G1, the AQ and the CRE, and he'd say, I'm doing this today, or I'm doing that tomorrow, I'd like a brief on that. Yeah, very orderly, very forward-thinking.
Was his manner generally formal or informal on these occasions?
Oh, I think in the briefing, very formal. I think when he took you on one side and he talked to you, it was totally informal and friendly. But, for instance, in the briefing, he always referred to me as the AQ, and he referred to the G1 as the G1, never Dick or Bill or anything like that. But when he went to his caravan, it was totally informal. And but he lost no respect in that. I mean, I had the utmost respect for him. And then he'd get in his jeep and off he'd go, or he'd get in his aeroplane and he'd fly off somewhere and he'd do a job. You always knew where he was, you knew where you could get him. He had a very good Australian ADC captain who was his pilot, drove him, and by and large the radio jeep, which was Royal Canadian Signals manned, by and large kept in touch. So if you've got to keep in touch with him, you knew he was A to B, you could catch him at A or B. I think a very orderly chap, but he simply was everywhere. And I got to know Jim extremely well. And I can remember him sometimes in the winter, in November, December, January, when it was a fairly lively front and you were quite liable to run into a very unpleasant bout of shelling. I can remember him coming back after dark and going into his caravan. I'd always give him an hour, then I'd ring him up and go in. And he was as brave a man as I've ever met, because he'd had a fairly rough World War I, and he was having a pretty rough self-inflicted Korean War. And I think his bank of courage, he was drawing on it heavily, and he had to force himself to do it. I know he did. He never said so, but he could see it. But he never refused and never balked, and I had the utmost respect for him. He was a great leader. Mind you, I'm totally biased. I thought he was a super chap. And to me, and I know to my staff, the poor, wretched, bloody man who had to slog away, the staff captain doing all the petrol, the ammunition and what have you, and know exactly where it was and what it was doing. They not only worked 100% for Castles, they worked that extra 20%. They worked 100%. He had that faculty. He inspired people because he was always charming and he knew your name. And he knew that you had a wife and 19 children, whatever it was, but he had a good touch and he was a tremendously amusing man too. And he handled visitors so well. And by God, he had enough visitors. He got terribly tired. And occasionally the G1 and myself could persuade him to take a day off and stay in and get up some back papers and laze about for a bit. But it was 7 days a week. And of course if the battle got hot, it was 7 nights a week. Tremendous chap. Best choice they could have made.
How detailed was his control? Did he control everything, or did he see his function as one of exercising a general supervision and sorting out intractable difficulties as they arose?
From the AQ's point of view, I very soon learned that he wanted to be kept in the picture so that he knew what was going on. He left the running. He said to me, "You are the commander of the services. I will give you orders, and you pass those orders on to the services. Now, the relationship that you make with the heads of services is up to you, but I'll give you my orders, and you've got to pass. Every head of service has a right of entry to me, and during the time I was at AQ, only one head of service revoked his right, and it was not, I think, history relates, it wasn't justified, but I rarely became the commander of the services." And, in fact, Jim would say, "Look, we want to do that generally." And all the deployment of the services, once I'd told him we could do it, he left all the detail completely to me. He never worried at all. He didn't send for his CRESC or his CREOC. He left it to me. And it worked. I got a new CRESC. He was a bit touchy at one time, but it only took a fortnight to get him into the team. What he did with the brigade commanders, my impression was that he never interfered, but that he was always there over their shoulder if they wanted him. He didn't command battalions and platoons and things like that. He was very exactly on his patrol program. He took a lot of interest in that, and I think he made the brigadiers toe the line. He told them what they wanted to do, and I think the control was pretty tight there, but he never assumed command of subordinate. He's really a paragon, isn't he, Castles?
He was setting objectives rather than planning means.
Yes, but he was there to help. The CRA, too, little Willie Pike, he was absolutely indefatigable. He was round his guns and OPs and brigadiers and everything and here, there. He was out all day. He was a splendid little man. Everybody adored him. And it was quite obvious that our divisional artillery got more and more efficient, and TOT was cut down, reduced. And there was a good divisional, HQRA staff too, very much part of the team. The DQ was very much part of my team, and the BMRA, Paddy Victory, was a splendid chap. Had a marvellous sort of love-hate relationship with the G2, Bob Thomas, but they operated together extremely well.